Feminist Buzzkills, the show that didn't realize John Cena looks so good in Birkenstocks.
So good. So good.
I'm Liz Winston. And so gooding with me is my co-host, Moji Alamodale.
Hello, friends. Today, we're going to look at Idaho and how it became one of America's anti-abortion strongholds and how one woman has created an entire movement and won't back down.
Plus, the trend continues of making up anti-abortion scare tactics to freak out the public. The latest one, abortion coercion. We'll break down the BS and give you the facts.
Plus, we've got guests. ER Fightmaster, comedian, actor, musician, and the first non-binary doctor on Grey's Anatomy joins us to talk about their sexy new EP that has us all hot and bothered.
And from Catalonia, that's right, Tanya Berja Mestra, the Minister of Equality and Feminisms, is here to make us all jealous that there is a cabinet position in Catalonia dedicated to feminism in all of its forms. What? It's amazing.
Pretty incredible. But first, Liz, you're back.
I am back.
Dukes held it down for 3 whole weeks. What were you up to when we were working so hard at the salt mine of abortion access front?
I mean, first of all, I just have to say that y'all just nailed it. It was like so fun to listen to, you know, while I was sipping some drinks, I could listen to the pod that dropped. Y'all had great guests. I felt kind of bad that I was on vacation for Abortion Provider Appreciation Week, but you were great.
We all deserve vacation. What were you doing?
Oh my God. Well, I went to Mexico and I feel like, tell me if you feel like this. Everyone's been talking about Mexico City and I feel like my whole Instagram is full of people going to Mexico City.
Yes.
And I just was like, I need to go to Mexico City. And so I went to Mexico City and it's like a cross between New Orleans and Paris and New York City. Green space, gorgeous. There was a political rally when I was there, just a little touch of like home. And then I went to San Miguel Allende, which is, you know, in the mountains, the cradle of the revolution. I had a fabulous time. I haven't had a vacation like that in a really long time. So it was really great to just be part of the resistance in our neighbor to the south.
You would like post some of the things you were doing and it just looked like a wonderful trip. I was a little bit jealous, but also having so much fun here with Dukes, who really was an incredible co-host in your absence.
Yeah, y'all are great. You know, I mean, you spent last year in Colombia, you know, just hanging out.
The whole year.
And I was just like, you know, okay, I'm going to go and have some fun. But you know what? You know what people hate? Other people's vacation stories. So I'm going to stop rattling on and we're going to dive back into the week's steaming news dump. So I'm going to kick it off because I'm back, baby.
Welcome back to the crap.
Thank you. It didn't get better while I was away. That's for sure. I'm going to kick it off. A creepy dad in Texas who doesn't want his daughters to have sex before marriage scored a big win from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, who ruled that minors must get parental consent for getting birth control, even at federally funded clinics.
Oh my God, you think dad jokes are embarrassing? Try dad lawsuits. This is a win for creepy dads everywhere and also a boom for the parental emancipation movement and the abortion movement, because let's get real, those kids are going to need abortions.
Seriously. And in other cringy birth control news this week, while Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs called on conservatives to pass protections for birth control, Senate Majority Leader Sonny Borelli said that women don't need birth control because they can just put an aspirin between their knees.
Ooh, get it? Get it? That's boomer for keep your legs closed. That's a classic. That's classic.
That is a classic. You know, if only Sonny had a brain between his ears so he could write a sexist joke that doesn't sound like it was stolen from Hee Haw in 1967. Hey, bud, if you're going to slut shame, do it so I don't have to explain to people under 40 that they were just slut shamed.
And finally, this story is truly a gift from God. The planned Arkansas Memorial to the Unborn, aka Bonehenge, to be erected on the state capitol is hitting a few snafus, as the artist may be relying a little too heavily on Jesus to do some of the logistics.
When asked by the state commission why the design was not handicapped accessible, she replied, "When we talk about handicapped spaces, I just want people to know that Jesus is still healing people and setting people free. So I guess if you're just waiting to be healed by Jesus, you'll have to wait to see the monument."
Oh my God. So her plan for ADA compliance is for a big hand to come down from the clouds and scoop people up, gently carrying them to the monument.
Apparently. And then when asked about how the project would be funded, she was equally delulu. She said, there's more than enough money. This project is funded by heaven. So apparently she thinks the song Pennies from Heaven is actually a financial plan.
And technically it has been funded by sperm deposits, but I digress.
Well, that's Spanish Demon News Dump. Come back next week and get caught up on all the crap.
Welcome back to the crap, Liz.
Thanks. I'm here for it.
Let's get to the stories we want to break down further. Kansas Rep. Rebecca Schmo claims that 2 decades ago, a doctor spent an hour trying to convince her to have an abortion. And she's using that to justify legislation against abortion coercion. Now, abortion coercion is a problem she made up to get around the fact that the Kansas Constitution and Kansas voters support strong abortion protections, but she hates abortion. Also, she never had an abortion. The product of that conception is now 21. So she was allegedly coerced into conversation. And I guess she just wants to protect everyone else from conversations about their own pregnancies. And just to add a fun little other cherry on top, this bill also includes almost $6 million in taxpayer funding for anti-abortion clinics whose entire business model is coercing people into continuing pregnancies. So that tracks.
Man, that is unbelievable. Because did she ever say why the doctor was talking to her about having an abortion? Did she have a fetal anomaly? Was it?
Well, yeah, she had a fetal anomaly. The doctor thought that the continuing the pregnancy could endanger her life.
But when she chose to not have the abortion, she was no longer coerced.
She continued to not have the abortion and continued to have a child. Yes, that is exactly what happened in her story.
You know what? This is such another long line in this trend of scaring the public about something and then pretending like if you pass a law, then that will stop it from happening. But really, when you pass a law to stop it from happening, it automatically stops happening because it was never happening to begin with.
Never a problem. That's exactly right. This is just another part of the anti-abortion grift machine, like born alive bills.
That old chestnut of, you know, abortions where you're born alive, like that just isn't even how abortions ever happen, ever. Like they just don't happen that way. And they make up stories about people leaving born children on a gurney and then walking away and then they die and stuff. And you're just like, that's murder. Like that doesn't happen. And there's also something called that.
Yeah, it's called infanticide. So we don't have to invent a new thing for a thing that doesn't happen. Also, it really does assume that doctors are out here murdering, right? That like sets up this assumption that doctors are murdering, which I think is a lot of the platform that legislators have, again, to stop abortion, to just assume that doctors can't be trusted.
You know, and I think that's a point, Moji, that we can't make enough, because in order for the government and legislators and the courts to take control, they have to make sure that they set up a system where we no longer trust medical providers. And that feels wild. I mean, shake it outside of abortion. Look at how many people believed like creepy Joe Rogan about eating horse paste and drinking bleach and all this other shit. All these like randos who were superseding Dr. Fauci during COVID. Like we're so susceptible to just throwing experts under the bus.
Yes.
What the hell?
It's wild. Also, when we're on the topic of things that antis make up that don't exist, abortion trafficking, which is also one of those new trends. This idea that A, minors don't primarily involve their parents in their abortion decisions. That's actually what happens. And that the minors who don't do that, it's because they're in unsafe situations with the adults around them. And it really does isolate the most vulnerable.
Well, also, the other thing when they start these terms, you know, the word abortion coercion, you know, when you say abortion trafficking, you're like, that sounds like human trafficking.
Yeah.
You know, what is that? You know, when it's just they purposely used a loaded term to say you can't help a minor access abortion care outside the state. And it just makes people feel scared that people are doing it and people aren't doing it. People are just trying to help other people get care.
And again, to piggyback on that idea that they basically take terms that mean something and then bastardize them to mean nothing, the primary form of reproductive coercion is actually sabotaging people's birth control and actually forcing people to continue pregnancies in dangerous relationships. And rather than trying to address those very real problems, they'd rather invent something that forces their narrative of abortion being bad and people who are trying to help people access abortion being bad and solve a problem that nobody needs solved.
But also goes back to what you said at the beginning of your story, which is some of the biggest coercion that we see in our movement is coming from these fake clinics, lying to people, coercing them out of choosing abortion care if that's what they need, and being so profoundly funded by tax dollars and by churches and by anti-abortion extremists, that that is where the coercion actually lies. So not only is it a grift, it's gaslighting, yeah, and it's turning its head onto us and making regular people feel like all the scary stuff is happening when it isn't.
And the Democratic legislators in Kansas, who are not in any viable majority, are pointing out that this money could be used to reinforce Medicaid. It could be used for midwives and doulas. It could be used for TANF, it could be used for all families who actually do have families and need help. And instead, I always feel like the anti-abortion clinic taxpayer money is just a grift. It's another way to siphon money from people who need it and line the pockets of people who donate.
That's right. And I think the message here on just when you hear these buzzwords and they sound scary to you, like coercion and trafficking and born alive, if it sounds like terrifying and scary to you, it's probably fake. Like, it's a really good reason for you to do some research. Our podcast will always be covering it, but, you know, look it up, you know, go to the Center for Reproductive Rights, look up some sources where it's like, is this a thing? And you'll get some information that it certainly is not. And certainly we're here to cover it. But that sort of leads into my story about Idaho, because when we talk about abortion trafficking, Idaho was the first state to introduce this abortion trafficking bill. And we on the podcast have talked a lot about Idaho in sort of piecemeal stories. But I think it's important to put Idaho into a fuller context of what's going on in Idaho, because we talk about Texas and Oklahoma and Alabama. And Idaho is, it's basically, it's kind of an island of awful, right? Yeah. You know, for decades, it's been the cradle of neo-Nazism. It's where white supremacy had gone and really flourished in the 1980s and through the 90s, home to the Aryan Nation and other white nationalist groups. And then over the past decade, that hatred has also bred a really strong anti-abortion movement within that white supremacist movement, you know, really welcoming groups like the Texas-based Patriot Front, who, if you've never heard of them, they're one of the fastest growing white supremacist groups. Like, since 2018, they've outpaced other hate groups 10 to 1 in posting racist propaganda. But they've been terrorizing clinics in the region. That means like Washington State, Oregon, and Idaho. And they've been getting really bad extremists elected to statewide office. And the reason that I want to lay out Idaho today is because in northern Idaho, where a lot of this horribleness is happening, if you have ever looked at Idaho, it's sort of shaped like the letter L in menopause. It's like kind of skinny in the top, and then it just kind of bloats out this weird L at the bottom. And kind of the worst part of what's happening happens at the top of this L, kind of bordering Washington State and Oregon. And this woman who is single-handedly fighting off people is in a state that has very few local activists. And so before I lay out about Jen and what Jen is doing, I laid out about the neo-Nazis who have this stronghold in Coeur d'Alene, which is near Sandlot where she lives. But the abortion mayhem, I remember hearing about it in 2015. There was this person in the state house named Vito Barbieri, and he actually stood up and said, "Why can't women just swallow cameras to get gynecological exams?"
What?
Yeah.
Beyond the fact that the digestive tract doesn't run through the reproductive tract?
Yeah, he thought it was attached those cameras? To the stomach.
Who's looking at those cameras?
But also, if that was the case, if you swallowed after a blowjob, you could get pregnant. So I'm like, dude, what? And a woman who was serving with him in the Idaho State House was like, oh my God, are you kidding?
He was like, this is a straight line from the mouth to the vagina?
Yeah.
One tube.
You got to read about this, dude. We'll put the link to the article in the show notes. It's really just so messy. These things happen because whoever your state attorney general is can mean you're living in a great state that's protecting rights, or you're living in a shitty state that's going to file lawsuits and just get all over the place. And the hostile environment around abortion has been sort of championed by this attorney general named Raul Labrador, who served in Congress. His whole raison d'etre is abortion, right? And so he has been just criminally passing a total abortion ban. They were a trigger ban state. They tried to pass a law that said that educators in colleges couldn't present abortion in a way that was positive towards abortion, which stopped like ethics professors and people like teaching debate, law professors. They all sued. Mm-hmm. Planned Parenthood sued. You know, it's like wild.
It stopped people from feeling like they could pass out birth control, I remember.
Yes.
People were like, oh, we can't even talk to college students about birth control because who knows what our attorney general will do.
That's exactly right. And that was the whole thing that scared people. You know, Planned Parenthood sued three different times. One to challenge the total ban. They lost. One to challenge a 6-week ban. They lost. And they also have one of those bounty hunting Texas bans where families can sue clinics for executing an abortion for somebody.
Including rapists. I believe a person's rapist can sue, which is so re-victimizing.
That's exactly right. And then they were the first people to fire the warning shots across the bow, too, about the purposeful vague writing of these laws. Mm-hmm. And they were the first ones to say, hey, we don't know if we can help our patients if legally we're going to lose our licenses and go to jail for over 10 years and be fined hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And that's why Idaho has lost almost all their OBGYNs. They've lost so many.
That's right.
And they've just left the state. And so bad that Idaho had to close a whole ward. Close a whole ward that served 500,000 people.
Yeah. And people have to now drive 45 minutes away into Washington State in that area for abortion care and the icing.
Not just abortion care. I'm sorry. Pregnancy care. Any sort of OBGYN care. Yeah. It's not just, you can't get an abortion in Idaho. That's not
true. No. And so the icing on the whole shit cake is they went so far that when doctors who were working in emergency rooms in Idaho were like, well, there's a federal law called the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act that says we're required by law to screen an emergency, stabilize a patient, and then transfer that patient under specific circumstances. That means that if abortion stabilizes a person, federal law says you have to. Well, now they're struggling with like, but Idaho law says I go to jail, lose my license, get fined if I perform an abortion to stabilize a person. And on April 26th, the state of Idaho v. the United States, that sounds daunting, is going to be at the Supreme Court. And that is Idaho's attorney general is so pissed off that he is taking this emergency room case and asking the Supreme Court to rule whether or not the federal protections for somebody coming to have an abortion will supersede Idaho's total abortion ban. So if Idaho wins, that means that emergency rooms across the country will all have their hands tied and won't be able to stabilize somebody with abortion care.
And that might affect everyone around the country.
That's exactly right. And so the OBGYN centers in the hospitals that you were talking about are in Sandpoint, Idaho. And that's like about 30 miles from the cradle of white supremacy. And it's where a woman named Jen Jackson Quintano lives. And Jen is the only activist in that area who is fighting. And she's doing an incredible work gathering community to try to protect abortion access.
Jen is absolutely a rock star, and she's also doing it unpaid. She's doing it because it needs to be done. But it also sounds like she is living in terror when you read about the work that she does. Whenever they choose to have an event somewhere, they have to have police come or they invite police. They look at videotapes and see that like shady looking people sometimes case the joint ahead of time. People are afraid to speak because they are afraid that they will be harmed by the people in their community. And this isn't a state where abortion isn't happening. This is just talking about the rights to bodily autonomy, the rights to abortion care. And it's terrifying. I tip my hat to Jen for feeling that she can do this work, because it's incredible what she's getting done.
I mean, her first thing, she did this public outreach to do abortion storytelling or reproductive rights storytelling, I think it was, just kind of bringing your reproductive experiences to a theater of 200 people, not knowing who was going to show up, hoping everything was going to be okay. And she has grown an army of fighters who are really pushing back. And she's really funny. She started an unhappy hour to gather people together so that they could work on pressuring the legislature and trying to uplift everything that's happening in Idaho, because I don't think we should leave out states like this. And I think often we do. You know, Idaho is a state of just under 2 million people, and they have the capacity because they have this attorney general who has gotten free legal, tons and tons and tons of free legal work from Alliance for Defending Freedom. And she's just fighting as hard as she can up against all odds. And I just wanted to uplift her work, because letting folks know what's happening in Idaho and that this one woman has fearlessly gone public to say, who's with me, and getting hundreds and hundreds of people to join her is really impressive.
And the work that she does really speaks to the power of abortion storytelling, right? It really speaks to the power of being able to speak to our experiences, because that's mostly what she's doing right now. She's not necessarily getting legislative things passed. She's just having people talk about their experiences and talk about the world that they want. And it's really changing minds and hearts in Idaho, and also giving people permission to have these conversations.
She's just a cool woman. She's an arborist for her job. And she's just really cares about community.
She's a parent.
Yeah. And, you know, she just sees that the maternal mortality rate in Idaho is terrifying. And she's really connecting with people who live in rural community who understand the importance of comprehensive reproductive care, regardless of their politics. And I think it's rare to find that. And she's really tapping into it. So her organization is called theprovoiceproject.com. Go there, throw some cash in the coffers, even just send a note to say thank you for what you're doing. I think that we should get Jen on the podcast. I think that's the next step, just to really hear some detail about what Jen is doing. But remember, it doesn't matter where you live. States can be passing things through this court system that affect you profoundly. We lost Roe because of Mississippi, and we could lose protections for emergency rooms because of Idaho. So good lessons to learn.
As always, these stories will be in the show notes, and you can find the best, most up-to-the-minute resources on accessing abortion care and funding your care on our website, aafront.org. Our Charlie chatbot on the bottom right will walk anyone anywhere in the country through their options and resources for abortion. I'm so excited to introduce our first guest. She's a professor of political science at the Pompeu Fabra University in Barcelona, and is also the Minister of Equality and Feminisms of the Catalan government. She's here to tell us about all the exciting things they have going on. Please welcome Tania Berja Mestra. Welcome, Tania. Hi.
Hey, Tania.
Hi, thanks so much for having me here.
Oh, thank you for joining us. Okay, so you're the first Minister of Equality and Feminisms at the Catalan government, a position created in 2021. Now, we're pretty jealous that there's a Ministry of Feminisms, plural, in your country, and that you are not a politician, but that you're an activist and scholar, and that you're running this ministry. It's like a dream. So how did the government tap you for this position?
As you said, it was also amazing for me. It's the first time that the government has a specific access for the feminist transformation, and it went along with the creation of a specific portfolio that would coordinate and lead the feminist transformation from within the government, and also contribute to implementing the mainstreaming, not just of gender, but also of the LGBT perspective, the anti-racism perspective. So full feminism, you know, intersectional feminism. That's a project for the global transformation and a fight against all systems of oppression. So it was great to have the opportunity to join this project, and also to have on board other activists and academics, feminist academics, anti-racist academics. And believe me, it does change how policymaking is done from this perspective.
Did you approach them and say, our government, in order for it to really be representative, needs this? Or did the government say, our government needs to have this so we can be fully representing all people?
So the party that holds the prime ministership is a Baathist party, a feminist party, and there was a strong call for having this ministry once for all from the feminist movement. You know, we consider it as a collective victory. Feminist policies are human rights policies, are fundamental rights policies, so they should have a seat at the table. At the big table, you know, with all that it means. It means veto power, it means more negotiation capacity, it means more budget for equality policies. Actually, between 2021 and 2023, the last budget that was passed, our resources have tripled. So it means that when you have a seat at the big table, things happen, and having more resources is more guarantee of rights for LGBT people, for women, for racialized people, you know, for refugees. It does matter.
I so love this. And I love that you have the support of basically the establishment. What kind of public support do you have for elevating equality and feminism to this level of importance?
I'm very proud of a country that has a strong feminist movement, a strong LGBT movement, a strong racial justice movement. So all these issues have a relatively strong legitimacy across the population. So it was not weird for the population to suddenly have this portfolio in cabinet. Basically, it was celebrated as it was about time. How could the Catalan government not have a ministry of equality for so long? And then people were asking, and why feminism? And why the plural S? Well, because feminism is both theory and praxis, and there are different currents of feminisms, and we don't want to represent a specific feminism. We want to embrace all the contributions that the feminisms have done throughout history. We subscribe to intersectional feminisms because, as said, this is a broader political project and it's about justice for all.
Yeah, that's our jam also, 100%. Mm-hmm. And also it just feels for so long, decisions have been made for people who are not at the table. So people do not understand the fundamental experiences and needs of communities that have never been able to bring forth that. They just suppose a lot of shit that we need, which is maddening.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when we got the request to talk to you and we heard about one of your big projects that you're working on right now, which is this menstrual equity project, we were super excited to talk to you because it feels like all of the issues that affect us the most. And in America, we don't talk about anything, right? It's just like, if it comes to equality or it comes to sexual liberation, reproductive liberation, you know, gender liberation, it's all in a closet. It's all very hush hush. So to talk about menstrual equality is incredible. So will you talk to us a little bit about what this menstrual equality plan looks like? And especially putting this fine point on it about reusable menstrual products, because I think that's huge.
Yeah, so sexual and reproductive rights are essential to the feminist transformation. As you said, they are essential for emancipation, for autonomy, and they are human rights. And since they are central to the feminist project, we made it central to the political agenda. And this means that we elaborated as a national strategy for sexual and reproductive rights. When I say national, it's Catalan-wide. That includes abortion, contraception, transgender healthcare, also other new rights such as menstrual equity. And this comes from crude reality, which is that many women cannot afford to buy menstrual products. So one of the goals is to fight menstrual poverty. And it's a social justice issue, but it is also about gender justice because we still don't know much about menstruation, about the climacteric. And there's lots of stigma and taboos and myths that can be really harmful for our health, right? So it's about gender justice as well. And the third goal is climate justice. It's reducing the tons of waste that single-use products generate every year. Only in Catalonia, we are speaking of 9,000 tons of non-reusable products per year. So that's a lot. And this action consists of the free and universal distribution of reusable menstrual products, meaning that women aged between 10 and 60, as well as trans men and non-binary people who menstruate, can go to any local pharmacy in Catalonia. And with the QR code that can be downloaded from the public healthcare system app, this QR code entitles them to get one free product. It's either a menstrual cup, a pair of menstrual underwear, or two clothes pads. And the advantage of doing that through pharmacies is that, well, you can find pharmacies across the country, even in small villages, right? So it's about guaranteeing access to the exercise of this, right? And at the same time, pharmacies can provide counseling on which is the product that might be more suitable for you, depending on your work schedules, if you do sport, if it's your first menstruation, if you're a girl, you know. So this is essential. And the Ministry of Equality and Feminism train pharmacists on sexual and reproductive rights, on menstruation, and on climacteric. So that's also quite an innovation.
It's awesome. In the United States, the menstrual equity movement is really gaining steam. And one of the things that the statistics that is bore fruit here in the United States is that people who menstruate who are in school, who are not adults, and especially who are living in situations where they're not necessarily even living in poverty. Some are, but they're living in under-income communities, have missed a lot of school because they can't afford menstrual products. And so I was wondering, do you also have products in schools, and are school nurses also trained to help folks who are in school access the products as well?
So this universal distribution of products is part of the menstrual and climacteric equity plan, which also includes the installation of dispensers in public services that would include schools as well as healthcare centers, community centers, right? We haven't get there yet, but we have been doing menstrual education sessions in high schools where the products were also distributed. We are also doing that in prisons because inmates do not have access to the products either. And they're also in the range of very low income, right? And socioeconomic deprivation explains very much of why they are in prison. So this is an action that's replicated in prisons as well as in juvenile centers. And the plan also includes working with grassroots organizations of disabled women, migrant women, homeless women, you know, so that we can adjust the actions to the specific needs of all these different groups of women, and that we can fight also the specific taboos or stigmas that different groups of women might have due to cultural backgrounds. You know, we need to make this action feel like it's their own, that it's not an imposition of something strange, that it's imposed by any type of fashion, right? So that they can own the action.
I love that you are basically making Catalan sound like a feminist paradise. But even when you talk about it, you did bring up things like period stigma and just sort of basically trying to reach people where they are. And so I'm going to be the negative nanny of this conversation and ask again, what kind of pushback are you getting from the community at all? Or what are the like barriers to educating people or having people fully embrace this initiative that sounds incredible?
There have been some, you know, there's, I wouldn't even say opposition groups or anti-rights groups, but, you know, these incel communities or just men that don't get feminism. And it's like, oh, and what about men? Shall we also get free underwear or, you know, shavers? Because we also have to shave and blah, 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 as if women didn't shave, you know? But yeah, that's I guess that's what they can process. But what's been amazing, and it counteracts any type of, you know, this small, tiny opposition, it's the amount of conversations that have been opened up in workplaces, in, you know, family chats, in the chats that it's, you know, parents from schools that have chats, and also everyone's discussing the initiative and also giving advice on how to use the menstrual cup so that, you know, it's in the right position or width of the product is more comfortable. So it really has been brutal in this sense. I mean, very rarely one has the opportunity, one being government or an organization, to instill such social transformation. You know, breaking taboos is very difficult because they are so ingrained in this patriarchal structure. So when suddenly there's an action that, you know, steers these conversations, I think many taboos are just gone for good, because the fact that everyone's now free to talk about it, it's just amazing.
Well, it's amazing too that this, it costs money, right, to actually implement this initiative. And I hate to keep bringing it back to where we live, but we are in a moment in the United States where women are literally being reduced to chattel at this point. And so to just imagine that a government is saying we must allocate funds because menstruation is something that happens and we want everybody to have the dignity of menstruation and we want to fund it. Like, I just can't.
I'm trying to wrap my head around
a government funding the dignity of menstruating people. I don't even have a question. I just don't even know what to say.
I totally get it, but there are substantial arguments. This is a public health issue. And you mentioned a key argument before. If there are women who are missing school because they cannot afford menstrual products, it also means that there are women that are missing work days because they cannot afford menstrual products. Beyond the fact that many women might also be missing leisure activities, sports, you know, it is affecting quality of life and well-being. And at the same time, well, climate change is also a huge issue nowadays. So we all need to be aware of that. But also, these reusable menstrual products are less toxic. They are much better for our health. They also help us get to know better our own bodies. In the last few days, I've been doing some talks in the Catalan news outlets. And some people that participated in these talks had these questions that they are very normal questions if you haven't used the menstrual cup before, like, would this fit inside? And it's like, well, do you know that every baby comes from the same place? You're going to put the menstrual cup? Of course it does fit there. Or other questions like, but I'm afraid it will fall. Why? Why should it fall? A tampon doesn't fall either, right? So it is very relevant that we have these conversations and these reusable menstrual products help us know much better our own bodies.
I also think we need to get women my age who used to use diaphragms to help people inserting menstrual cups because right. It was like, it was a dream. I used to use my diaphragm all the time instead of paper products because it was easy and it caught everything.
I came to reusable products really late in my menstruation journey, which I'm still on. But once I discovered like a cup, I was like, this is a game changer. Like, why?
Me too. Yeah.
It literally is a game changer. But also I understand like the learning curve was steep. I remember the first time I tried to use it being terrified. I was like, what is happening? Where does it go?
And we also get to realize that the menstrual blood does not stink. What's stinky is the liquids that are used in you know, the single-use products.
So on top of attacking period poverty, which is incredible, we are the abortion podcast, right? We are Abortion Access Front. And Catalone, the feminist utopia that you're telling us about, also has the widest coverage in terms of centers of where abortion can be accessed and making sure that it's equally available and performed for people, not just legal. Because here, well, we used to have legal abortion everywhere. And now we only have it some places. When we think of this region, we think of Catholicism. And is Catalone a Catholic stronghold? Like, I don't know. How do you make this happen in a country that we imagine as outsiders as being deeply religious in a way that religion is keeping us from having nice things in the US?
Catalonia is one of the most secular areas within Europe, but it goes beyond that. I mean, the right to abortion is guaranteed by a Spanish law. This is a Spanish-wide law because it's a fundamental right and it's regulated by an organic law. But the access to the right is guaranteed by state governments or regional governments, right? Because the health system, the education system, the basic fundamental social services are our competency. This is what explains why Catalonia has 40% of all abortion centers that currently exist within Spain, right? Up to 2023, women had the medical abortion guaranteed, let's say, in a territorially equal way. Because Catalonia has a broad network of sexual and reproductive health units that are ascribed to primary care centers. So the medical abortion could be provided from any of the centers, but surgical abortion was only provided in a few places within the country. So it meant that women had to travel long distances. Long distances for Catalonia is not the same as a long distance from the United
in this
States.
In this huge country we live in, right?
A long distance in Catalonia might be like 100 or 150 kilometers, but still we believe that that was not properly guaranteeing the right. So in 2023, so in a year and a half since we made it into government, we had guaranteed that in all health regions, which is the subdivisions of the public health system, women could effectively choose between the surgical and the medical abortions. Also, we revisited the extant protocol for abortions to strengthen the accompaniment that the professionals, the medical professionals, must do to women in terms of information, respecting autonomy, also in terms of the controls to be done to identify whether the woman is in a gender-based violence situation or if she has other needs that are not covered, you know, and other public services can be offered, as well as offering her a long-term conception, if that's her choice, of course. Because that was another innovation we introduced, which is making long-term contraception free for all women in Catalonia. That's going to be a reality in 2026. But for the women, it's free for all women under 30 years. Also for all women with socioeconomic deprivation, as well as for all women who are in a situation of gender-based violence.
That's amazing.
So it sounds like the secret is infrastructure.
Yeah, exactly. It's a public health system that's territorially distributed so that it guarantees that you can effectively exercise your rights close to your home.
And does the cost of an abortion covered by the public health system as well?
It is a public service, so it means that it's fully covered by the public health system. Yeah.
Wow. So what's the next big goals as you are looking at expanding this incredible Catalonian utopia? What are you looking at next?
So in terms of sexual and reproductive rights, it's the full development of the menstrual and climacteric action plan, and it's putting focus as well on climacteric, because there's still there's a lot of things that we don't discuss about menstruation. This is going to change through the actions I've explained. But what about climacteric? Women know even less of the climacteric. Look, when we adopted the plan, we were told, don't use the word climacteric because no one will know what it is. Use menopause, that more people identify what it is. But climacteric, no one knows about. I was like, yeah, but the feminist ministry cannot use the wrong word. We need to explain. We need to be pedagogical that menopause is only one of the phases of the climacteric. So we need to empower women about what the climacteric entails, what can be expected in terms of symptoms or in terms of, you know, manifestations, and how can we deal with it, and the actions that workplaces can also implement. We have already implemented some measures in the public administration for civil servants, which is an 8-hour recoverable hours in the next month. So when you have one of those days with your menstruation or your climacteric, in which you have an impact on your health or well-being, you're allowed to take these hours off. And then in the next few months, you would recover these hours. But it needs no medical certificate. It's just your responsibility declaration. You know, it's implemented since October 22, and it's working very well. And we have debunked any expectation of this always reluctant sector that, yeah, now all women every month was going to take these 8 hours out. No, they don't. They use them when they need it, right? And so that the use has been correct.
That's so great, because the thing that I find maddening about the people that complain and set up that scenario, it really sets us up as people who are looking for ways to not work, or we don't want to be part of that. We love being involved and being part of the process. Nobody wants to take themselves out of their work or their careers or their families. We chose to be there because we want to be part of the solution. So to think that we're opting out for reasons and that we would like make up shit. Oh, I have cramps. I have to be gone. Like, people don't do that.
People don't do that.
No, we don't. And another challenge is to implement comprehensive sexuality education at its fullest at all educational levels. So we made it curricular to decrees passed by the government. It covers from preschool to secondary school. Making it curricular means that it must be taught, and it's not going to be a single course. It needs to be discussed with different courses, subjects, topics, you know. At early ages, it is about preventing child abuse and empowering children to identify when such a situation might occur so that they can talk to an adult and get out of that situation. And then it's about empowering people to get to know their bodies. It's also prevention of sexual violence. It's also normalizing sexual orientations and gender identities, you know, in its plural, as it should be, right? So we are engaged now in a participatory process with both the education community, but also the NGOs that have been working for long on sexual and reproductive rights and have been doing workshops and talks at schools, and also with the consultative councils that the Catalan government has with the feminist movement, as well as with the LGBTI movement organization, so that relatively soon we have all the materials and the different curricular itineraries for all the different ages and courses.
And we know that this protects children, right? We know that this protects our communities to know both how our bodies work, how our sexuality works, and also to be taught what to look out for, what is yours, what is private. I feel like this is incredible. I am verklempt. So impressed.
We'll be happy to host you here.
We'd love to come and have conversations, because I think that you have a lot of information and have really skillfully centered the humanity and what feminism means and how everybody benefits by feminisms. And I think that I'm all for learning from you and teaching Americans how to rethink the importance of introducing this into our lives every day.
Oh, 100%.
Another topic we are working on, we adopted a plan to eradicate obstetric violence and vulneration of sexual and reproductive rights. And this also has an embedded intersectional approach. So it means that when the health system needs to provide adequate sexual and reproductive health care to lesbian women, to trans people, right? To disabled women, because the facilities and equipment are not always prepared for undertaking a correct examination, right? To disabled women or a neurodivergent person. So training needs to be provided to all the medical profession to put at the center women's autonomy in decision-making, right? To avoid unnecessary medical practices, for example, unnecessary cesarean sections, right? Or to get to know better how to detect earlier, much earlier, endometriosis, which might take ages for professionals to identify. That's another game changer, I think, because we have been for long infantilized, not treated adequately, right, in gynecological or obstetric examinations. So this should be over.
Anya, I feel like you're just here showing off, and I, for one, am enjoying it. I really am. And thank you so much for coming and telling us all about the incredible work that you're doing. It is so exciting to hear. And I can't wait to follow and see what other greatnesses you guys are doing out there.
Let me also highlight the amount of respect and admiration I have for all the women platforms and organizations that are fighting this backlash that's occurring in the United States. There are two things in the history of women's rights that we know for sure. One is that no women's rights has been accorded, that they all have been conquered through organizing and mobilizing. And second, that we can never take women's rights for granted, because setbacks can always appear. So I would encourage all women to organize at local level. And I would also ask men to mobilize, to get abortion back and to have sexual and reproductive rights fully protected in the United States, because sexual and reproductive rights are human rights, and they are human rights for all.
We couldn't have said it better. Thank you so much. And thank you for the fight and for the inspiration. And we're going to come visit you in Barcelona.
I'm really so looking forward to having you in Barcelona. Thank you very much for having me here.
Thank you, Tanya.
Thank you. As Tanya so beautifully said, we want to encourage all people to get involved in defending their sexual and reproductive rights, which are human rights. Link to their socials are in the show notes.
Okay, I'm back, baby. So it's time for the party game that's faster than Monopoly and more fun than Taboo. It's 6 degrees of abortion. This is where Moji takes a story from the news, and I have 6 chances to link it to abortion. Let's see if she can stump me this week. Moji, what is the story?
All right. So Kristen Stewart of Twilight fame is doing the promotional tour for her new film, Love Lies Bleeding, which looks incredible. But more than that, she is literally serving looks. And so I would just like you to take some time to link Kristen Stewart to abortion.
Oh, my goodness. Kristen Stewart to abortion.
Raging lesbian.
Is she a raging lesbian?
I don't know if she's raging, but she's definitely a lesbian.
How do we know that?
Because she said it on SNL. She said, I'm totally gay. Years ago.
Oh, she said it years ago?
Yeah. And as I say that, I realize I see the 6 degrees in my head. I can't wait for you to fail.
All right. So let's see. Twilight is probably where I'm going to go. But like, what do I know? Is she married?
She's not married.
All right. I feel like I should be able to tie Robert Pattinson somehow to somebody else through abortions. But like, I don't know. I think I don't really know enough about Kristen Stewart. So you might You might have stumped me.
Nice.
Kristen Stewart, because I don't really know anything about her other than she was, now I know she's a lesbian.
Yeah.
And that she was in Twilight.
But she keeps kind of a pretty low profile, actually. But I'm just remembering the SNL when she hosted and she said, I'm totally.
Well, I guess if she was on SNL, that would have been my in, right? She was on SNL and Cecily Strong did her abortion story and they're tied to abortion. But I didn't do that.
That is not what I was thinking, though. It was her on SNL and her opening monologue was about how Trump kept cursing, like basically tweeting bullshit about her because of her breakup with Robert Patterson. And Trump, as you know, ushered in the judges who ended abortion in this country. And so that was the link I was going in. But you're right, the Cecily Strong one is a little more precise and cleaner.
That's also, you know, they're both good. But I'm going to say that I didn't get it. And then you walk me through. So you win. I fail on my week back. I'm back, baby. And then I fail.
You know, I was doing not so bad when you were gone, too. I think I won at least the last one.
You did great.
Yeah, thank you. That was fun. Anyway, she's looking great on the promotional tour. She's wearing no pants. She's wearing high-cut underwear things with blazers, and it's just fantastic. I'm loving it.
She's hot.
Yeah.
She is fully hot.
Absolutely.
Speaking of pop culture, I do know who this person is. Our next guest, gracing us on the pod, is a comedian, actor, musician who just dropped your new favorite Sexy Time soundtrack called Violence. Please welcome to the pod the first non-binary doctor on Grey's Anatomy, the hilarious ER Fightmaster. Hey, ER.
Hi, ER.
Hello. Hi.
We are so thrilled that you're here. And I have to tell you that I was like in a bad place and you popped up in my TikTok and I went down your TikTok rabbit hole and I was like, oh my God, someone who's super hilarious and super mad about like so much of the shit that I'm super mad about, that it was joyful. And then I was like, well, who is this person? They're amazing. And then I just was like, I don't know where I've been in pop culture, but like, we have to talk to ER because they are so amazing and have done so much stuff. And then when Moji and I were just blabbing just about all your work and what you were talking about, I stumbled upon your pinned tweet. And I just want to say, we say this oftentimes, the only dead name we have is Twitter on the show. So we will dead name Twitter.
Yeah, fuck that bitch.
Yeah, fuck that bitch. And I loved your story just of how you came of age and how you came to be. And you were someone very different growing up in Ohio through self-discovery. And it felt like if you pinned it, you might want to talk about it a little bit more. So I'd love to talk just a little bit about how Ohio ER Fightmaster 1990s came to ER Fightmaster now.
The crux of this pinned tweet basically was like this idea of, first of all, I grew up in a much more conservative generation than a lot of these like young kids. I did not grow up necessarily online until I was like in my mid-teens. I grew up in a real like Adam Sandler playing people with disabilities was like an okay thing to do. Like, you know, Shallow Hal, Gwyneth Paltrow in the fat suit and us having to take a magic pill to find her beautiful. Like, I grew up in an era where there was a lot of inappropriate and kind of like hate-based comedy. And I grew up in Ohio where I was in a monoculture. It felt very white. I could not see any other queer people, so I did not know I was gay. And I think I wanted to, and I still want to have the conversation that I don't want people to not come to the light because they are worried that it will be too much to atone for their sins. I don't expect you to be born woke. I don't expect you to be born with a women in gender studies degree. I don't expect you to be born knowing who you are. And I think we have to have grace for people being on a journey. And so when I pinned that tweet, I was really saying, like, I know that you see me as someone who's like doing the work right now, but I did not start. I was not doing the work even 10 years ago. And so it was kind of like a kumbaya of like, let's have some more grace for each other. I know we always have the conversation now of like, you don't have to talk to anybody. You don't have to explain yourself to anybody. But if you do explain yourself to somebody you love, you might make it easier for the next person that's like you, the next person with your identity, to have an easy time with that person. So yeah, that's just the headspace I'm in right now. I want everyone to have a little bit more grace.
I love it.
I do love that headspace. And it seems like you're a strong defender of something called non-toxic masculinity, which we mostly thought was something we could only dream of. So could you explain what that is? Because that's more of where you are now and how you embody it.
Well, I think I like masculinity. I feel like a very masculine person. And I think that I was really lucky. I had a really masculine father, but outside of American culturalism. So he was a guy that was in the military. He was a guy that was very buff. He was a guy that worked outside of the home, and he cooked all of our meals. He wasn't great at math, so he had my mom do all of our like financial stuff. She also worked outside of the home. He played with us whenever he could. In that way, he was our most like primary caregiver. When he was working for the military, he was writing for the humor column. He is this like beautiful, soft intellectual that loved being a dad and loved being a husband to my mom and loved being a protector. And my mom was is this incredible academic who's really sharp and really fast and didn't want to cook and didn't want to take a last name and like brought us with her to her friend's house. So I'm seeing a really kind of gender neutral in this way look at life. So I didn't understand gender until I started to go outside of my little bubble and realize like, oh, like women are the ones that stay home.
They're doing it differently.
What is going on? Yes. And so when I talk to people about masculinity, they're like, oh yes, this toxic masculinity. I'm like, well, let's make sure we're talking about the same thing, because what you're talking about is domination, right? And domination is not actually a facet of masculinity. So if someone's convincing you that their masculinity is domination, that person is not feeling confident in their masculinity. So you're allowed to not be attracted to that. But I want to be masculine with you. I want to celebrate all the things that are masculine, that are playful and confident and goofy and suave. I want to celebrate all those things with you without you ever fearing physical violence or mental violence. So that's non-toxic masculinity for me.
I just want to go back a little bit because I've never been interested in taking anyone's name, but I would take Fightmaster as a name. So I disagree with your mom on that one little point.
That's why I find it so principled, because I'm like, of all the names to take, that she was like, I'm not doing that shit. I was like, you know, that's impressive.
It's really impressive.
It's true. You know, I think everything you just said, you could replace with the word Christianity. It's like, mm-hmm. There's good Christians in the world who reject all of the shit around it. And I think that like reclaiming masculinity from the dominant norms that you said is something that I feel like we should all be better at, right?
Yes.
Non-toxic masculinity shouldn't be a thing that we're surprised to hear. You know, and so I think we need to spread the good gospel of non-toxic masculinity, Moji. I'm here for it.
And make space for it, right? So it actually goes back to that pinned tweet. Like, let's make space for each other, because in this conversation, if we all lump it on, we say, well, you know, this masculinity is bad. Then the right really has this field day of being like, they are trying to skin our boys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They don't want us to be men. No, I want you to be men. I want you to be men that go to therapy. I want you to be men that find equals and enjoy your spending your life with someone that you intellectually respect so that your sex is better and more consensual. I want you to feel joy. I don't want the only emotion you feel to be rage or elation at a football game. I want you to feel the full spectrum of your humanity. That is your right. So be masculine. Just be safe.
I know. It's so shitty that dominance is, it seems like the foundation of culture, you know, like, and just breaking that, you know, white supremacy dominance thing. And just listening to you talk, you're like, I love that seemingly, because I've known you now for about 6 minutes.
And it's been wonderful.
You know, it's been so the best good. 6 minutes that I've had this morning. So I feel like it's great. And I've had a really good morning. But it feels like you have come to a place where, exploration doesn't equal fear, and not knowing and things like that don't equal fear. Like you it feels like you're going head into things that you don't know, and self-exploration especially. And we were just like wowed by, like, it was really hard to write this interview because we were listening to all these podcasts you were on and like just so excited. And one of the things that was sort of a through line in a couple of different podcasts was you talking about something that, like, looking at life as like a constant project of growth. And I feel like that is real. But what I wanted to ask you, for those of us who are on that journey, but way behind you, is there something that you haven't started thinking about or that you're putting off in your growth that you're like, I really got to work on this and I haven't gotten to it yet, so that we can actually all feel like you're immortal?
Yes. Oh, my God. Certainly. I'm afraid of getting in trouble. I'm really afraid of disappointing people. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons I have that conversation of like, be graceful with people is because, like, you know, I'm sure a lot of us feel this way. Like, you know, if you grew up in the 80s or you grew up in the 90s or the early 2000s, you know, the way we joked was different. The way we talked to each other was different. The way we behaved was different. The way that we're hoping and expecting people to behave now is not the same. And so I look back and I wonder if there's people I hurt, or if there are times I could have been kinder, or if there's jokes I shouldn't have made, or when I was trying to be satirical, was I really being hurtful? And I know that those things exist. I think that, it kind of crushes me in a little bit because I'm telling everyone, like, let's be graceful for others, but I'm really not having that grace for myself because I don't want to disappoint the people that I'm like trying to bring with me. You know what I mean? I don't want to say something that's hurtful. I don't want to have a not educated opinion. And I'm trying to make that space for myself. And I'm trying to be kind, but it is kind of like the feeling you have when you go to a party and you wake up in the middle of the night and you just think like of the stupidest thing you said. Mm-hmm. And maybe it wasn't the stupidest thing on earth, and maybe no one remembered it, but I'm spending a lot of nights like,
what the living fuck?
Like just like going back in time, not that this is a real example, but being like, oh, trans versus trans mask. Excellent, ER, you fucking idiot. Like, you know what I mean? Really kind of parsing my shit apart all the time.
I think that's what I wake up every night and I think of, and it's not even, you know, you're like trans mask. Like, whoa. I'm like, oh my God, that thing I said in 12th grade,
yes,
to that person.
Oh my God.
As a person in my 40s, like, it's, I'm up all night just really unpacking that and feeling real bad about how that person might be feeling. Meanwhile, that person probably doesn't remember my name or that story, but
I'll give you a real one because this one haunts me all the time. And this was, I was like, I think I was in middle school, and I don't know, in middle school you're just such a fucking moron.
You're an asshole.
And you're an asshole. And I went, God, I'm going to call her Sarah. I was like, God, Sarah, are you deaf? Because she just like, the teacher was repeating something over and over again. And she turned around and she went, yeah. And pointed to her earring aids. And I was like,
oh my God.
And I'd been in school with this person, when I tell you, a decade. And had just never noticed because I was so self-centered.
Yeah. I'm a secondhand embarrassment for you.
I went to dinner last night and I thought about this. Like, it never leaves my body.
That is so real. I grew up poor and Catholic. So you're constantly in Catholic school, mm-hmm, with a bunch of kids and families with giant problems that you don't even know. And finding out after the fact how mean, mm-hmm, people were to us. But then also you would find somebody that you would transfer your meanness to who was like lower, yes, on the food chain. But like finding out later, kids that we had sleep over at our house, my parents were really great. And my mom would say, why don't you have so-and-so sleep over this weekend? And I was like, my mom's so cool. She wants everyone to sleep over. And then finding out later that like that dad was a massive creepy alcoholic and she wanted, yeah, those kids to just have a moment of peace at our house. And I think, you know, it's just a mess.
Of course, if I had a kid, I would just be like, be as kind as possible. And it's not coming. I want to explain to them that it's for them. Every time you are mean to somebody, every time you get the joke in at somebody else's expense, every time, not in the way that like straight men say it to women, like every time you gossip. No, like in the way that we all know we do sometimes, like when we gossip with malevolence, every time you do it, it stays with you. Then it stays with you, and maybe no one will ever find out about it, but it stays with you. And so I'm like, lead with kindness so that you can sleep at night. Don't be like your old man. Me.
Yeah.
So, ER, you must have known that you could sing forever because your album is incredible. Why did comedy and writing come first?
I was always a funny person. That was my superpower, was I was always the funny one. And so I actually did not know that I could sing. And I didn't know I could sing because my mom could sing and my brother and my mom would sing all the time. And so that was their thing. And so I would write all these songs the entire time I was growing up. I would write all these songs in private, and I would play on the piano when no one was home, and I would play on the guitar when no one was home, or I would go up to the attic. And it was just something that was very private, where I was like, I know I'm bad at this, so I have to keep it private. And it kind of just felt, now it feels like I was just like honing a skill for 15 years. You know what I mean? Like really just doing a thing in private. So
quietly doing the work.
Yeah, quietly doing the work. But comedy, when I was 19, I moved to Chicago and I started doing comedy at Second City. And that was the most right thing I've ever done. It was so natural and it gave me such confidence because it was like this perfect mix of things. I was in school for women and gender studies. I had skills like writing music and singing music that were hidden and only known to me. And then I had this confidence of being on stage. And so I had this superpower where I could go on stage and I could make thoughtful jokes that brought everybody in, because I was in women and gender studies. And so I wasn't making jokes from a position of dominance. And I was as goofy as I ever was when I was a kid, and I was trying to hide my queerness. And, you know, queer kids are the goofiest kids on the planet because they're like, anywhere, look anywhere but me. Look, I'm doing a character. So I had that. And then when we really were elevating and becoming like better comedians and starting to tour and do all that, I was writing music and playing them live for the show because I had the confidence to do that. And it wasn't until I got out to LA and started doing TV that I was like, oh, you know, the part that I miss is the singing. And so I started a band and I started putting out music.
It's so interesting that you said, like, you know, your comedy was not coming from a point of dominance, because I do feel like your album is a little bit of a fight towards cis men, like very obviously. Yes. Like the first song, you're literally saying, I could fight him with my hand behind, with one hand, because the other hand is busy.
Yes, I am so excited for you to hear the next EP. Like this is so Violence is the EP that I released in October, and I wrote that whole EP is about falling in love, but I wrote it from an angry place of like, all these anti-trans bills are happening. We're in a culture of abuse right now, and I'm really seeing these patterns of mediocre men harming wonderful women. And actually the entire culture coming behind the mediocre man, mm-hmm. and being mad at women for leaving that system or for questioning that system. And you don't have that as much in queerness. And so I'm kind of watching that from the outside. I mean, like, oh, so this is the culture you want us to join. So you're legislating against our trans kids and you want us to join this culture of domination. I'm going to fucking kill you. That was like the genuine thing I had. And because I can't kill them, because I don't want to go to fucking jail.
Yeah.
I realized that the only way to torture them was to have queer sex and experience queer joy and live in queer community. And that is violence to their system.
Yeah.
So that is the violence and domination are separate things. Like my violence to them is I'm hot and I'm happy and I'm having a good time. And I'm having a good time with people that have left your system. And that is killing them.
It does kill them, because that system also, but when you choose joy as violence towards them, they can't combat it and they don't know what to do. So they try to kill it. And I think what they're so mad about, and Moji and I were talking about this after we listened to the EP, is first of all, it's really fun to say, I love violence. I love listening to violence.
Violence is so good.
But it also felt like, and this might be just getting into the weeds and putting way too much onto it, but we were saying that it felt like, anybody's not a cis dude, right? Listening to it felt like a permission slip, if you never had one, to hear somebody tell you it's okay to experiment, to go mm-hmm. outside of your comfort zone because it would be safe, but to just like literally go for it. Just like fuck with reckless abandon. If you've never heard of that before, mm-hmm. this, like, you can literally just put the album on pause and be like, do that to me. Okay. Like, let's do that now. Because that's what it really felt like. Like, emotionally, it just felt like if you've never been able to let your sexual freak flag fly, this felt like a safety net with which to jump into. Put it on. Let's go.
I love that. I really feel like I did my job then. I think the thing that I love about queerness, and queerness is a political stance, you know, it's your internal cathedral, it's the way that you fuck, it's all these things. The thing I love about queerness is I think that queer people and people who identify specifically as queer are people that are saying, I can really find the internal cathedrals of a lot of people beautiful. And they're less focused on genitals. And so they keep calling queer people perverts. But actually, we're like, no, I can find a lot of souls gorgeous. And I think the thing that stops a lot of women from basically experimenting or stepping outside of, you know, heteropatriarchy is they're like, well, I just don't know if I could, you know, do the thing. And I'm like, listen, when you get in it and you're with a person you're excited about, you're not thinking about genital this and genital that. You are experiencing them in full. So being queer is leaving the mindset that we are Legos fucking other Legos. We are souls that are blending in this really hot and horny way. And it's a better way to live.
It's a much better way to live. It's really inviting.
Yeah, it's fun.
So you've talked about your healthcare experiences and how you have not received compassionate and respectful care as a queer person, as a trans person, as a non-binary person. And we've heard from other non-binary and trans colleagues something the same. And we have a lot of listeners on this pod who are people who practice in these fields. I know you can't speak for everyone, but can you share somewhat of how they could improve in their language, in their bedside manner, so that folks that don't identify as cis women could feel safer and more encouraged to go to the doctor?
I love this question. Yes, I think that a really simple one is, first of all, a lot of medical forms have gender, pick one, mm-hmm. M or F on their forms. But we're not picking our gender. And because if we were picking our gender, then you'd follow up with pronouns. You're asking me about my sex, and that is fine, but I need that clarity. And I need to know that your institution knows the difference between sex and gender. So when I'm filling out a format, you don't need to know if I identify as masculine or feminine, right? As much as you probably didn't need to know about what my genitals look like if I'm in for a gynecologist appointment. You know what I mean? So having sex instead of gender is a big one. And then if gender is added there optionally so that they can better understand who you are before they even get in the room, great. And then I think we need preferred names, because there are people that I know that have initial names. This is a cishet man that I know that is very important to me. He's Jim and everybody calls him JR. And if he were to go into that space, he'd be, I'm JR. And they would just go, okay, great, JR, thank you. And they'd move on. But there is something about transis where when they're trying to figure out where they are like, but what does it stand for? But what does it stand for? But what does it stand for? We just want to know your real name, that they're not doing to cis people. So I'm going to say, in this order, I need you to ask for my sex instead of my gender. Then gender is optional if I want you to know me better. Then I need you to ask for my pronouns so you can respect me in the room. And then I need you to ask for my preferred name. And that, once all those things are done, that's the only version of me that you need to understand. You don't need to understand my birth name. You don't need to understand that in the eyes of the law, I am a woman. You don't need to understand that this is what you need to understand to take care of me.
You're right.
And here's what my genitals look like so that you can also take care of me.
You can look at them. Yeah.
Yes. Also, if I'm going to present my genitals to you, like, let's be clear. I don't care how much college you've had or whatever. Anytime you're presenting your genitals to someone, if someone doesn't think that they need to earn the trust of and make that a trusting, I don't care if you're fucking them. I don't care if they're providing you healthcare.
Yes.
If you have hubris that you're a physician or a medical person and you mm-hmm. get to just wag around without any respect towards that situation you're putting somebody in, it's a mess.
Yes, I agree. And also, what about intersex people? Like, if I'm an intersex person and I walk into that office and you've got two options for me, like, and this is, you've got two options for me so that you know what my genitals look like, which also, I'm sorry, is probably not important a lot for a lot of, like, mm-hmm. my dermatologist
just don't need to know.
You know, your dermatologist does not need to know. Zero.
Like, why? Yeah, why? But, you know, if I'm going in for any type of appointment that requires a look at my genitals and I have two options, what the hell am I feeling in that moment? I think the whole system could be more, I'll go back to it, kind.
Yeah, I think that that's right. We have to wrap up, ER, and it's really sad because it's really fun to talk to you, but we are an abortion podcast, and I would just love to ask you, just if we can briefly just talk about like how activists in the abortion space can do better at being inclusive, because it's not just cis women that have abortions.
I'm going to go outside of gender on this one. I'm always trying to find language for the opposite side of the spectrum, right? I'm always trying to find language for bringing people in. And I think that we, as people who believe that you should have the choice and believe that abortion should be something that's readily accessible, as important as it is for some of us to be militant, it's also important for some of us to find the whisper tone, like, I understand exactly what you're like. Okay, yes, like, it's a life immediately. I understand that you believe that. And I respect that. I absolutely, you know what I mean? Like, finding the gentle way to not invalidate the way that they're feeling and instead go, yes. So if you believe that it's a life right away, I completely understand why this would be stressful for you. And imagine bringing that life into a world where it was not wanted, where the person having it, it was against their will. You know, can you imagine giving birth in the... I'm always trying to find that language. And I think sometimes that gets interpreted as you're towing the line. I don't believe everything that I'm saying, but I believe that it's important to get people to our side. I believe that the best way to get people to your side is to feel that even in a moment, they're being listened to. And then when they get over here and they're listening to all the facts and they're like, oh, maybe I will change my mind. They'll never get there if you don't go, I hear what you're saying, 100%.
You know, it goes back to the very first question we had where you were like, let's meet people where they're at so that you can have those conversations, right? So I think meeting people where they're at is something that we do the least and we should probably do the most. Quite frankly, it's like, that's the work we all need to do on our work and our journey.
Well, I love talking to you guys. Thank you so much for having me.
This is so good.
We love you. And thanks for bringing us joy and bringing us insight and being awesome. Continue being awesome. And hopefully you'll come back and talk to us again.
Yes, please.
Oh, I can't wait. The next EP is so much more violent.
Oh my goodness. I cannot wait.
And we can't wait for that. What's it called? Can you tell us?
I'm actually going to tell you, and I haven't told anyone else yet. The next EP is called Bloodshed Baby.
Totally moving away from violence.
Bloodshed Baby.
I'm not supposed to be saying this to you, so I am going to get in trouble, but it's called Bloodshed Baby, and it is really a counterpiece to violence.
I cannot wait.
ER, thank you so much, and we'll have you back on when it comes out so we can talk about Bloodshed Baby.
I can't wait.
Thank you.
Thanks. Find all of ER's socials in our show notes. So listen to their EP Violence, Get Your Sexy Time On, and keep an eye out for a new EP coming soon.
Liz, that's our show.
Woohoo! It's a long one, but a good one.
It's a good one. Thanks for listening. And thanks again to Tanya Berja for defending sexual and reproductive rights in Catalonia and giving us a blueprint for how to fight for reproductive rights everywhere.
Did we make you smarter today? Make you laugh? Show us some love by liking, subscribing, and giving us a 5-star rating. Plus, stay connected with us on social media at Abortion Front across all of our platforms. Turn that enragement into engagement. Want to do further engagement? Sign our petition. We want you to go to aafront.org and ask the FDA to use their power to protect mifepristone.
Looking for where you might fit in to do some abortion activism? We've got a 5-part activist training series, Operation Save Abortion, at operationsaveabortion.com. And visit our super cool activist calendar, which is full of local and national actions and educational opportunities. Planned Parenthood Action Fund and Queer Space Collective are hosting a 2-part virtual training for volunteers. The first session is March 19th from 5:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. Central Time. The topic is creating LGBTQ+ welcoming spaces. The goal of the training is to develop tools to create affirming spaces for LGBTQ+ youth and adults and illustrate the importance of supporting transgender and non-binary folks in our community. The link can be found on our activist calendar.
You know, I'm back and then we're dark. Isn't that the way it goes, right? Next week, we are dark because we are preparing for the Supreme Court case with mifepristone. Moji and I and the team are going to be down in Washington, D.C., and we are going to be listening to the oral arguments with the one and only Professor Michelle Goodwin. We're going to give you the play-by-play of what the justices said, what it all means, and what the creepy-ass vibes are going to be like outside of the courthouse.
Oh my God. It's going to be so great and terrifying.
All at the same time.
And join our Patreon. You'll support great content and get cool FBK merch and experiences. All pledges support this pod and all of our activism at Abortion Access Front. Pledge at patreon.com/feministbuzzkills. FBK is edited by Remy de Tournay and is produced by Abortion Access Front.
Finally, we leave you with Mary Harrington, a woman showing us her whole ass when she reveals she thinks what's missing from your sex life is fear.
It seems to me that a good place to start would be a feminist movement against the pill and for rewilding sex, returning the danger to sex, returning the intimacy, and really the consequentiality to sex. And a great deal follows from an intentional reconnection of women's opting intentionally to reconnect with the fullness of our embodied nature.
Feminist Buzzkills, the podcast from Abortion Access Front. New episodes drop Friday. When BS is poppin', we pop off. And if you want to support our podcast and all the work of Abortion Access Front, like, subscribe, and join our Patreon at patreon.com/feministbuzzkills.